Esther 3, verses 1 through 3. Esther 3, 1 through 3. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, advanced him, and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. And the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, Why transgressest thou the king's commandment? We're at a turning point in the Persian Empire. There's a new queen, and perhaps there is even a new administration come to the Persian palace. Whatever the underlying motive, two of the king's doorkeepers, we learned at the end of the previous chapter, eunuchs, chamberlains, two of these doorkeepers had conspired to assassinate the king. Their plot, however, was made known to Mordecai. And Mordecai had relayed this information to Esther the queen. She, in turn, has the matter revealed to the king. She certifies it in the name of Mordecai. That is, she gives him all the credit for having uncovered this. And then upon having it searched out, of course, they find this to be true. There is indeed a conspiracy. There is also a swift end to this conspiracy, because the conspirators, Bigthan and Teresh, find themselves uncovered, captured, and finally put to death, being hanged upon a tree. Now, I think we can see in this story of conspiracy at least a little bit of a hint of the insecurity that actually surrounds all thrones which are not established upon the preceptive will of God. The fact is, such despots rule by the providence of God, but they often rule against his precepts. It's a responsibility of those who have possession of magistratical power. It's their responsibility to exercise it with respect both to the rights of God and to the rights of man, to exercise that power in accordance with the law of God. But that is not often the case. And so apart from either, apart from having respect for the rights of God or at a very basic level the rights of man, what happens is, as happened in the Persian Empire, it encourages what we would call autocratic rule. And as we've seen in the case of the Persian Empire, what this means is that the liberties of the multitudes are very often made subject to the whims and desires of one man. It's only where the principles of God's word are enshrined in the Constitution and the national life that law and liberty actually can go hand in hand, and where the people are going to enjoy the greatest degree of genuine freedom. Not license, but genuine freedom. Now, there is in that that story, in the previous chapter, a contrast between two fidelities being held forth. The first is the fidelity of the doorkeepers, and the second that of Mordecai. Now, the former show themselves to be men lacking even a natural fidelity or natural loyalty. And that's really kind of amazing if we consider. They have an advantage, a tremendous advantage, living in the palace of the king. They were taken into his trust. But these two, you see, as all believers, they were harboring in their heart treachery, and it just took the right occasion to bring forth the treachery that is in all men by nature. They lived a big lie. They feigned the highest fidelity while they were conspiring at the same time the lowest rebellion. These are men who are lacking all natural affection. These are men whose hearts were moved by envy of their superior. They were what Scripture would call despisers of dignities. These were not men moved to rebellion because of a higher concern for the rights of man. And they were certainly not moved by any concern for the rights of God in the Persian Empire. Their motives were not at all driven by any concern for the glory of God or for his justice in the land. In other words, this was wicked rebellion against one that they acknowledged to be their superior. This was not the rebellion of godly men against an ungodly ruler or an ungodly constitution of government. So in this, then, they resisted God, because God is the one who has set order in all human society. And they did so without any pretext of obeying God rather than man. Now, contrast what they did with the fidelity of Mordecai. Mordecai actually has no natural affinity for the king. At least he shouldn't. In fact, as a Jew, he had every reason to bristle at the very thought of the Persian Empire. Every time he looked at that palace in Shushan, every time he got up and went into the court, it must have made him cringe a bit. But you see, Mordecai was a prophet and he was a friend of God. And Mordecai observed providence, but not without an eye as well to the preceptive will of God. And so he saw the hand of God working in the elevation of Esther. He knew the times and the seasons. His then was not a fidelity to an infidel king, nor was his fidelity to a king who was a tyrant. Mordecai's fidelity, no matter how it might seem at first glance, Mordecai's fidelity is actually a fidelity to God, first. And second, it's a fidelity to the people of God. See, Mordecai's loyal response to the king didn't really arise because he was so concerned about the king, per se. His concern for the king arose from a desire to see the cause of true religion advanced, to see the deliverance of the people of God. His concern for the king was properly subordinated to his concern for God and his truth and the cause of true religion. Mordecai didn't have this response as a result of some stupid notion of passive obedience to someone who merely possesses a seat of government. He wasn't a seceder. He wasn't, a member of the Free Church Continuing either. Mordecai was of a different stripe, a different cloth, a different fiber. In other words, Mordecai doesn't make known the conspiracy because of his belief that Ahasuerus is a lawful, sovereign, and rightful ruler of the people of God. How could he and remain a faithful Jew? How could he without breaking covenant with God? Rather, Mordecai makes known the conspiracy because he had confidence that God had placed Esther in the position of queen, and that by extension then, any assault on the king would endanger Esther, and by further extension, would endanger the people of God. Mordecai knew then that the conspiracy of Bigthan and Teresh was not the kind of rebellion that would bring liberty to the captives. They weren't going to set the captives free. Their rebellion was very likely only going to be the kind of rebellion that would bring a different kind of tyranny to the captives. Because Mordecai knew that the only thing that stood between the Jews remaining in captivity forever, perhaps, and being delivered was the elevation of Esther. And so Mordecai knows then that this plan for rebellion, this is not going to succeed. They're not going to succeed because they're not doing it to the glory of God. He knows that there's another purpose, and so he knows that there's a reason that this has been brought to pass, and the reason must be somehow to serve the interests of the people of God. He's not simply submitting to providence. He's interpreting providence in the light of the word of God, the promises of God. And finally, notice that fidelity to God is precisely that which leads Mordecai to a certain very circumscribed and subordinate fidelity to the king as a husband of Esther. Nevertheless, this loyalty to true religion and the cause of God's truth is that which will prove to be the means by which God brings deliverance in due time. Right? It's loyalty to God, not to the king, which has positioned Mordecai for the next cycle of providential occurrences. In verse 1, after these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him, and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. After these things, you know, the chapter unfolds the next event which occurs after those which had been previously related. Now, it was during the 7th year of the reign of Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, that Esther has been elevated to be queen instead of Vashti. Shortly thereafter, we come to understand that there has been this conspiracy of Bigthan and Teresh, which has been revealed, and Bigthan and Teresh are put to death. The next indication of time that we're going to have in Esther is going to be in the 7th verse of this chapter, which will bring us to the 12th year of the king. And so, what that means is that whatever has been related here must have occurred sometime subsequent to the former events, and yet it must allow for enough time for the events which begin to unfold in verse 7 on the first day of the 12th year of Ahasuerus. So sometime then, in the space of these 4 years, probably, as shall become much more clear as this unfolds, it's toward the latter part of the 11th year of his reign that we're talking about. In other words, this elevation of Haman probably occurs sometime toward the end of the 11th year of his reign, sometime shortly before the beginning of the 12th year. And we know that, I think, because of the events that are going to unfold in the 12th year. I think it's notable in all of this that our author has not bothered to give us any account, certainly not a strict accounting, of the activities and the intrigues of the Persian court. Not interested. That's not the point of the book of Esther, to give us that. We do, as I've pointed out before, we have parallel accounts in the ancient historian Herodotus, in his book on the Persian Wars, gives us information about what's going on politically in the Persian Empire, and also in terms of the wars, some of the things that are going on outside of the Persian Empire. But that's not the purpose of the book of Esther. Fact is that in the book of Esther, from the point of view of the author of Esther, who I, as I said, I believe is Mordecai, the events of the court are of interest only to the degree that they have bearing upon the story of the church. So we don't need all of that detail. You know, we're skipping some of these things. I'm only referring to them really to help us develop a better sense of chronology and to have a little bit better sense of where we should place all of these events in the broader scope of world history. The fact is, in the Bible, years can pass that are of little or no interest from the point of view of redemptive history. Right? I mean, between the Old and New Testament, we have a period, an intertestamental period of 400 years, where we know nothing by inspiration, although we do have other records, such as in Maccabees. The quiet interval does tell us really nothing of why the next important thing happens in the chain of providences designed for the deliverances of the people of God. Right? It really is related. The things that are related are related in order to set the stage for the next tiny miracle in this dizzying array of providences that make up the grand miracle which the Jews commemorate by Purim, the deliverance of the Jews. Now, the rabbis, I think very interestingly, understand this phrase to mean, this phrase after these things, to mean after God had prepared the solution, he creates a danger. And if we look at the unfolding of the book, there is a sense in which that really is true. You know, there is sort of this quiet spell. We have some events, then we have this quiet spell. In the previous events, what we had was the solution already being created and all of the necessary effects of that solution trickling down into the solution, and then we're met with the next danger. But the danger that is to arise in Haman has already been provided for in what we read of in the story of Bigthan and Teresh. And so there's already help on the way, even though if you were alive at that time, you may not have seen it. But that's important to remember because God doesn't work in a different way now. God works very much in the same way. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote. Now, I think it's notable here that this event occurs after the queen had been elevated and after the king's life had been saved by Mordecai. What that does is it gives Esther and Mordecai a previous claim to Haman. He stands in line, actually, first to be rewarded. Mordecai, that is, stands in line to be rewarded first. And remember, he didn't get a reward yet. And that was very unlike the Persian kings, very out of character. But the event was recorded, and that's going to be important later. So he's really, it's like Esther and Mordecai are standing in line first. Now the word translated did promote is in the PL, which means it's intensive. It means to raise up or to elevate. And so I think there is in this some comparison to what we've already read of the elevation of Esther. And so in going back to the theme of the rabbis, God has created the solution to this danger that's arising now by elevating her before the danger of this elevation of Haman is ever made. Now, this promotion, as we're going to see, is really for two reasons. First of all, it makes the subject of the promotion very high profile. And everyone who knows him by name is going to understand then, and they're going to see really what happens to him when he resists the congregation of Israel and tries to make war against the people of God. And that wouldn't be so apparent, would it, if he was a private person? You know, at this point, the Jews tell several different stories. One of them is, I think, a very interesting story that I'm just going to summarize, but it is along this lines. They talk about a man who does something very, very distasteful to a king. But he's just a commoner. And rather than kill him for it, what the king does is he puts him over a series of years through a series of advancements till he raises him to the highest place in the kingdom. And then the other shoe drops and he brings him forward and he executes him for what he did. By doing that, he's able to have the entire attention of the kingdom called to this man. And that's really what's happening with Haman here. Haman's being brought to a position where he's going to be the focus of a lot of attention that he wouldn't have been had he not been promoted. It's true, he wouldn't have been able to make war against the people of God in the way that he did, but it's also true that the lesson of what happens to people who make war against the people of God would not have been so signal had he not been promoted. Now, the second thing about this promotion is it actually sets this man, Haman, up so that he acquires greater honor and wealth. And that's also important because, you see, as we're going to see later in this story, all that he has is going to become the property of Mordecai. And so, had he not been promoted, he really would have had nothing. But because he'd been promoted to such a great status in the course of repaying or making restitution, which is what he's doing, he's going to have a lot more to give than he would have had he simply remained some relatively unknown or lesser figure. And we're not told in the story of Esther why he's promoted. We're not given any insight into that at all. Right? We don't know why the king is so concerned to raise him up, if he did something special or if he was somehow related to the crown. We just don't know. Because the fact is, the pretext, and that's all it is, the king raising him to this spot is really just a pretext. The pretext for his elevation is not so important as the fact of his elevation. You see, because unlike Esther, who is going to give herself for the welfare of the church, this man is going to ignite a fire of opposition that will press to exterminate the people of God. And that's the important thing here. The important thing is what he's going to be able to do from this position and how he's being held up or will be held up to be an example. After these things, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite? Now, if you read the commentaries, there's actually quite a bit of discussion regarding the genealogy of Haman based upon this and some other passages. There's been debate as to whether or not his name is Persian in origin. I suspect it probably has some basis in that, which I'll describe in just a minute. The meaning, the primary meaning at least, from a Hebrew point of view, seems to be magnificent or great. And as such, as we're going to see, he certainly does embody many of the traits of pride and boasting. Now, Haman's advance is parallel with the temporary decline in the prominence of Esther. So she's sort of declining a bit. He's being elevated. And with the eclipsing of the influence of true religion, what we see is in the administration of the throne, pride is going to predominate. Behold then, Haman the Magnificent. That's sort of what we can gather from this name. As I say, the name Haman is likely derived from the Persian, actually. The Persian, and it's a reference to the spirit Ham, or Hauma, a spirit connected with the sacrificial service amongst the Persians. Ham represented the life-giving power in this heathenish worship, and Ham was symbolized by the moon. They said to be the son of Hamadatha, a man whose name is clearly Medo-Persian. His name means double, or perhaps more significantly, it means something more like gift of Ham or gift of the moon. And so what we evidently have here is a man who is from a very religious family. We shouldn't think of Haman simply as a heathen, a godless heathen. We should think of him as a very religious man in his own right. And even by hereditary right, he claimed the name of the Persian spirit, as it was very common among ancient priesthoods to find them descending among families. And so Haman very well may have been a priest in this line. We shouldn't be surprised. You know, false religion feeds the pride and the foolishness of men. Now, calling Haman an Agagite undoubtedly forms a contrast with Mordecai descended from Kish. Right? Saul was the son of Kish. Saul had been rejected as king precisely because he had failed to kill Agag, an Amalekite king. That's important because under Moses, God had declared that Israel should blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. If you look at Deuteronomy 25, verses 17 through 19. The war of Amalek, we were told, was to be until Amalek was exterminated. And here we find one who has all of the properties and characteristics of Amalek. You know, interestingly, even today when the book of Esther is read, at least read during Purim, whenever Haman's name is mentioned, the congregation shouts to blot out his name. Now, the point of all of this is to display Haman as a type of the perennial enemy of the Jews, one which would be destroyed in time. Furthermore, the name Haman actually sounds like the Hebrew word Hamon, which means tumult or confusion. And I think that's also an alliteration that probably isn't lost on the Jews who hear this book being read aloud. So King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hamadatha, the Agagite, and advanced him. He was lifted up. Haman was lifted up. The promotion was a lifting up that carries him beyond any natural progression. Because look, Haman jumps ranks in order to achieve the advancement bestowed by the king. Now this suggests that Haman has caught the attention of the king for some reason. Again, we don't know the reason, but it does suggest that there must have been something that he had done or some connection that he had had. But again, we don't know what it was. However, we are gradually able to see that his promotion is from God. As the psalmist says, promotion cometh neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south, but God is the judge. He putteth down one and setteth up another. And yet all of this is for the ultimate purpose that he might be cast down in his pride. Again, the psalmist says in Psalm 73:18, surely thou didst set them in slippery places. Thou castest them down into destruction. Very significantly, Haman will define his official position with many honors which will fall to Mordecai. Everything that he's doing, everything he's going to get, the wealth of the wicked is laid up for the just. The accumulation of wealth, power, and prestige is only going to serve to redound to the future glory and success of Haman's enemy, the Jews, and particularly Mordecai. So we're told that Ahasuerus advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. Now this, we see that Haman has been elevated to be the chief minister or the grand vizier. That's the term that is used in the East. What that means is he was the highest official that would serve the Persian king. And this elevation had placed Haman above all the princes that served the king. So from obscurity to a place of unparalleled power, Haman is moved with breathtaking swiftness. And in this, very much, he is a contrast and to be compared with Esther. Verse 2. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed in reverence to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. And all the king's servants, all the servants, or the slaves, as the word can also mean, the slaves of the king. This is a group that contained all the courtiers and guards of the king. The bodyguards of Eastern princes were often given the title of slaves. It's been noted that when the son of a Persian nobleman was admitted into the rank of bodyguard, he claimed the title Ghulam e Shah, that is, slave of the king. You may have heard of the Shah of Iran. The Shah of Iran was really the king of Iran. Ghulam e Shah, the slave of the king. This was considered to be the proper attitude then of everyone who served the Persian despots. They were to assume the attitude of slavish devotion to the absolute monarch. All the king's servants, they were in the king's gate. The ones in particular view here are the men who assembled daily in the courtyard and gate of the king. These are the ones who sat daily before the king, some giving counsel, some providing security, many simply employed in the various day-to-day meeting and fulfilling of every need and desire that the king would have. Now, those who were inside the gate were of a more trusted class of people, but they were also a class of people utterly dependent upon the whims of the king. You know, there were benefits, there were also great costs with that. You had the benefit of the crumbs that are falling from the king's table. But you also had to worry when the king was angry because you were there at his whim. All the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed in reverence to Haman. Look at the note, the mark of the king's slaves. They bowed the knee, they kneeled to Haman. Their expression of devotion is actually intensified with the second word here. The word reverence in Hebrew connotes prostrating oneself to the earth. So they bow themselves and prostrate themselves to the earth. Yeah. Now, both of these words are used extensively in Scripture of religious worship, but they also have some civil ramifications. Now, according to both the Targum and the Midrash, which is Jewish exposition on the book of Esther, Haman had the image of an idol embroidered upon his garment. Now, I know the text doesn't tell us that, but if we understand his name, this may well be a true story that they're telling or a true relation. It would not have been uncommon for him if he was, in fact, in a long line of priests for Ham to have some sort of idol embroidered on his garment, like an image of the moon. So, as I say, why this might comport well with what we can surmise about Haman because of his name and his family name, there isn't anything explicit in the text indicating this. Instead, I think we have to remember that Persian monarchs and their high officials were often treated to this kind of religious devotion. They were seen as the embodiment of the divine on earth. They were, from the point of view of those around them, ruler gods who possessed many of the attributes of divinity in the eyes of their subjects. And so consider that the worship was not because of any necessarily, at least, any outward or manifest idolatry. Instead, the slaves of the king were idolaters of the worst kind. They were heart idolaters, those who believed the lie that simple possession of the throne was enough to make one the recipient of divine favor and divine sanction. They didn't yield worship because he was a man possessed with the qualities which God requires in a magistrate. Nor did they reverence him because he was a minister of God to them for good. And I think this is actually the point at which the rabbis are aiming. This reverence that they had was rooted in some other claim than that of natural morality or of even special revelation. And as such, it was clearly a species of idolatry. All the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed in reverence to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. The reverencing of Haman was not because he was a minister of God for good. It's ruled out by what the text tells us. Although he may well have thought himself a minister of Ham, the Persian spirit god, that's not really why they're worshiping him. He certainly didn't demand the honor because he'd achieved power through the consent of the governed or the will of the people. The Persians, if anything, we can say they were not deluded by modern democratic ideals. The demand to bow in reverence was rooted simply in the command of the king, in whom alone, according to Persian thought, all power was vested. The king didn't answer to any god other than himself. His word was law, rex lex, the law of the king. Rex lex, the king is law. This word from the king was enough then for his slaves to place all their confidence and trust in him. So Haman possesses his power and office through the providence of the king and according to his precept, not according to the precept of God. Everything is about his investiture with the office is thus saith the king, not thus saith the Lord. Bowing and reverencing, well, that's what you do if you're a slave to the king. Bowing and reverencing to Haman is just obedience to the king. It's worshiping the chief officer. And in doing so, what they're doing is bestowing worship upon the king. Thus, and while Haman's possession of power existed by the providential permission and even the predestinating will of God, we can affirm that, it could in no wise be construed to be a higher power or a moral government ordained or appointed by God for good. There was in this constitution no reference to God. There was in this constitution no concern for his moral law. There was in this constitution not even any regard for any precept of God in any meaningful sense. Indeed, as we're going to see, Haman existed by the providence of God for the express purpose of putting a face to the forces of evil that are arrayed against the church and people of God. So we shouldn't be surprised by what we read next. All the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed in reverence to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. You see, Mordecai rejected the idolatry of the Persians. He didn't bow the knee. He wasn't going to pay his respects to the idolatry that Haman represented. No, Mordecai, as I said before, Mordecai was no believer in this evil doctrine of passive obedience that is put forth by so many. He wasn't constrained by the fond conceit of that cowardly spirit of those who preach and teach that simple possession of power is enough to establish the presence of a legitimate authority. Not at all. Not only did Mordecai reject the idolatry of the Persian monarchy, its false religion, He refused to do anything that would demonstrate any kind of reverence to Haman. In other words, he wouldn't recognize a civil authority founded upon and rooted in the claims of idolatry. And he wouldn't because, as I indicated earlier, Mordecai was a Jew. As he's going to tell them and remind them in the next verses. Mordecai was a man under covenant bonds. He was a covenanter. His citizenship or conversation was not in the kingdom of the Persians, but before the face of God in Christ. Now, this verse is actually cast into the future tense, as a number of the rabbis have noted. And thus, they took it to mean that Mordecai not only did not bow the knee or express any civil reverencing, but that he declared that he would never bow the knee. In other words, he's staking out a position not only for the present, but for the future. And he's making it clear that no one in the future is going to be able to dissuade him from it. And the reason is that Mordecai saw Haman for what he really was, an Agagite. Mordecai saw Haman as a man who, together with his whole race, did abide under the just curse of God. And his conscience would never allow him to bow. There's nothing that you're going to bring to Mordecai to change his mind. Verse 3. And the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Then the king's servants. Now, who is it that's most disturbed by the actions of Mordecai? Those who are the king's servants or slaves. Those who are possessed of the slavish character of people who've been subjected to dehumanizing oppression and grinding obeisance. These are the people most forward in demonstrating their slave mentality. These people that we're talking about here, these are the ones who are the most indoctrinated by the state. They possessed the minds and the characters of men who've been stamped with the evil doctrine of passive obedience. These are men who've been taught to reverence a system of civil rule which seeks neither the rights of men nor the rights of God. Remember, Persia was the third beast that Daniel saw. A system of government which ruled by rapine and through a brutish projection of raw power. There's no pretext of being a moral authority here, a higher power ordained or ordered under God. These men, these king's servants, these slaves, these are men who were grist for the mill of heathen statism. And the king's servants who were in the king, which were in the king's gate. And not only were these men indoctrinated in the heathenish statism of the Persian Empire, we're assured that they were also very much incorporated into it. These are not the people like many who stand afar off and worship from a distance, you know, the idolatry of the state. No, these are like no other. These are men who are involved at the very center of the administration. They're at the king's gate. However, they're not there like Mordecai. They weren't advanced by a special providence. Right? They were advanced to that position rather by a slavish striving to find a place of honor in the empire. That's why they're there. And that's exactly why they're so quick to honor it in Haman, because they desired it for themselves should they come to that kind of position. These are the people who are most indebted to the system being in the employment of the royal court for purposes very different from those of Mordecai. Their interest is slavish and selfish, whereas Mordecai is bending all of his actions toward the glory of God. And the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, these slaves to idolatry that were the idolatry that was the Persian Empire and system of government, this is, they're slaves to this, and they can't keep themselves quiet when they're faced with the spectacle of Mordecai not bowing or even yielding reverence. Can you imagine not voting, right? I mean, they're not going to serve on juries. They're not going to. Mordecai's just not giving them what they want. He's not going to take that oath. He's not going to enter into that kind of incorporating, entangling, ungodly alliance. And it's driving him nuts. And so they're pictured here as being moved to speak as if with one voice. And I think the reason is because, you know, such is the wonder of the ungodly. When they see true religion in action, when they see true consistency of religion before them, they have, as it were, one single thought, as from one single mind. They're moved to ask from the consistency in Mordecai's profession. That's really what it is. And what's interesting is Mordecai is not like so many who think, well, you know, church is for Sunday. You know, that's what we do over there in the cathedral, right? In the world of the Persians, religion had set times and places in which it would show itself. The fact is, Mordecai, like all true believers, is telling us true religion shouldn't be limited to practice in a temple, a cathedral, or a church, or upon some certain holy day only. True religion has consequences, implications that have to be carried out in the daily affairs of life without regard to any of the artificial constraints of men. Now, for those who are incorporated in the world and its ungodly system, Christians indeed are men to be wondered at. And for those most devoted slaves of heathenism, they must be queried. But they're not asking questions in order to find the truth, but rather to find a reason, an excuse for persecution. And the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Now notice the nature of their concern. They don't so much care to know about the nature of true religion. That's not what they're asking about, is it? Although, as we will see in the next verses, you know, Mordecai does tell them he is a Jew. But they could hardly care about that. They could hardly care to ask Mordecai simply why he didn't bow or show reverence. That wasn't it at all. I think they probably suspected there was something about his religion. The question shows that his guilt is already assumed vis-a-vis the commandment of the king, and that was all that really mattered to them. You know, they already were assuming that he was a bad guy. How could Mordecai, being himself sitting in the king's court, how could he fail to recognize the proper protocol for all of this heathenish devotion to the monarch and to the idolatry in which it was wrapped? How could he not get that? Didn't you get the memo, Mordecai? I mean, everybody else did. Aren't you going to follow it? Why won't you be like everybody else? Why won't you do what everyone else is doing? And it's not really a matter of what is true religion, or, you know, why is this important? Why is your conscience binding you in this way? No. It's really a question, you know, why aren't you just going along with the crowd? Why aren't you agreeing with all of us? Why don't you see what we see, or maybe what we don't see, right? We don't see. None of us see. What is it you see that none of us see? Why are you different? And there is here, actually, I think, a greater note of concern for Mordecai than for Haman. Right? Because they don't actually ask him why, when they're asking, they're not concerned as to why he doesn't reverence Haman. Right? They don't even mention Haman. They go right to the king's command. Why did he transgress the king's commandment? You know, if it was just a matter of not bowing before Haman, maybe they might have been able to excuse it. No, but you didn't put your hand over your heart when everyone else was saying the Pledge of Allegiance. You didn't stand. You didn't show your patriotism. You didn't show your religious devotion to the religion of statism. So if he hadn't bowed before Haman, that might have been excusable, right? They might have been able to write that off in their minds. But the fact is, it carried with it some notion in their minds that he had therein disobeyed the king. And that's where they're sticking. Now, I think there are several things we can consider on these verses. First of all, think about the motions of providence that are set before us here in setting up a man so full of pride as Haman. You know, we're told in the Bible, pride cometh before a fall. And it's hard to imagine how a man like Haman wouldn't begin to swell with pride when he saw the hand of providence upon him, finding such favor with the king, advancing him to such a position in which the greatest men of the kingdom are expected to pay homage to him. Boy, that would feed his pride, wouldn't it? He doesn't see, nor does he care to understand the end of the matter. Haman isn't thinking beyond the present. He's not thinking about the long-term ramifications. It's nothing like that. Again, remember the words of the psalmist, "Truly, O Lord, thou hast set him in a slippery place." In a very short time, Haman has been advanced above all princes. But he does not give any indication that he's reflected on that fact that some power has placed him in this position, and that same power that led him to this point could bring him down again. Never occurs. You see, it's much better, really, for a man to enjoy prosperity after a long and steady effort than to find too much success too quickly. Early success in youth, is often the undoing of a man's character. And too often it caters to his own distorted sense of self-worth. It's much better to find success when we come to possess it honorably as a reward for a long life of conscientious toiling. Haman has been set up for a terrible fall, and he doesn't even see how bad his position is. Now, I want to consider a different thing, a different point, and that is that Haman bears his success in a manner very different from Esther. She's assumed the royal crown and uses it to reflect well on her husband, the king, whereas Haman, as is apparent in the following verses, Haman perceives in himself something worthy of himself. He perceives in himself something worthy of his own aggrandizement, right? He doesn't really have a proper perspective on what has happened to him. And he's one of these guys who probably thinks, you know, this fell into his hands and somehow he deserved it. The fact is, both have been elevated by the hand of a mysterious providence. But only one of them is going to actively bear the honor to the glory of God. And that's because Esther knows and believes, but Haman does not. Haman is an idolater. He's a heathen idolater. And it makes all the difference in the world. Esther is going to wear this providence as the garment of heaven. Haman is going to wear his providence as the prize of fate. And the reason is Esther has grown into her honor through a lifetime, we've been told, of filial obedience. She's grown to this. She's come to this by obeying God. Whereas Haman falls into this position through what might be called a simple twist of fate. Only one is going to welcome the end of the elevation of providence. And that's because only one of these people will improve the providence by applying to it the preceptive will of God. It's not enough to have something by the providence of God. Your duty as a Christian is to join the preceptive will of God to that, or it will all be in vain. Consider again the real contrast there is here between those who fear God and those who love the praise of men. Now, those who love the praise of men are slavishly devoted here to the heathenish idolatry of Persian worship and Persian statecraft. They stand ready to honor whomever the king honors, regardless of whether or not it's right or wrong. Doesn't matter. My country, right or wrong. They stand ready to defend the command of the king without any respect to whether or not the command of the king is conformed to the law of God. And look at them. Together, they're at once offended and intrigued by the consistency and the courage of true religion that they see in Mordecai, aren't they? Nevertheless, they're not so intrigued that they want to know too much. They don't really want to know about the true religion. But it does catch their attention. Now, in contrast to them, while the others were bowing down like beasts, there was Mordecai. Mordecai was standing erect like a man living amongst those who live in the fear of man. Because Mordecai didn't care, nor did he even consider what man could do to him. He knew that his life was in the hand of God. His trust was in God. His faith was in the covenant promises. There was neither fear nor reverence when Haman passed by. What a contrast. When the nobles of the world all bend themselves toward their idol, not Mordecai. Mordecai doesn't do it. Consider again that despite having some concern for Mordecai over Haman, at least they don't bring up Haman when they first challenge him on this. These men taunt Mordecai with the charge of disobeying the king, and this is not going to go away, as we're going to see in the next few verses. Whatever the approach, you need to remember the wicked and unbelievers, they're not friends of believers. They may feign it for a time, but in time, the truth of that relation is going to come out. And if it doesn't, all that it means is if you really are a believer, you've not borne proper testimony to your faith. You know, Mordecai may sit day after day with these fellows in the gate. He may work with them, but they're not really his friends. And their inquiries, well, their inquiries, they're going to keep making them, as I say, we're going to see. They're going to lead to trouble from which only God can bring deliverance. And of course, he will. And finally, the story of Mordecai and Haman should remind us that righteousness has its own reward. We shouldn't be envious of the wicked in their prosperity. Rather, we should go, as the psalmist says, to the sanctuary of God and consider their end. Haman is not going to last long because a righteous providence is going to bring the devices of the wicked to naught. You see, ultimately, Haman is in trouble because the honor and dignity of Haman is no match for the glory of the God of Israel. And deliverance is going to come. It's going to come, and Haman is going to pave the way in his own blood and at his own expense. So in the book of Esther, we need to remember, things are very seldom as they appear, at least at first blush. Because without the revelation of God, providence is a closed book, unwilling to yield her secrets to any who despise God. And that should tell us one other thing. The problem of evil really only exists for those who do not know God or his righteousness. And all of this, in the book of Esther, will shake out in favor of the people of God. And of that, we can be assured, and of that, we haven't heard the end. And that will continue next time. Amen.